Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Hope you're all enjoying a relaxing weekend and are ready to kick around some challenging ideas about our understanding of the world. You know, on this program, we often hear from writers and researchers who espouse very different views of our world, our history, our achievements, and failures than the views generally accepted as true by mainstream historians, archaeologists, and scientists. When we poke and prod around in dark corners and out on the fringes of accepted reality, and it's fun. It's fun to hear about other ideas and consider other possibilities. And it's important, I think, to provide a platform for those whose ideas are considered too radical or crazy for academia, even for journalism, which, as I can attest, does not operate under the same ground rules as science does. But, you know, I would never expect that you believe or embrace everything that you hear on this program, or for that matter, on some TV shows that cover these kind of topics that are undoubtedly on the must-see weekly viewing schedule for many of our listeners here. You know the ones I mean. You know, they provide alternative views of human history and development, the idea that we had help along the way from someone else, someone more advanced, some civilization from elsewhere, building on the ideas that were popularized decades ago by von Daniken and others. And now, they have massive weekly audiences. The Ancient Aliens program, for one, similar platforms online that explore that kind of ideas, other media as well. You know, suddenly you look around, there are aliens everywhere, inventing this and sharing that and impregnating and building and messing with our DNA and giving us all kinds of dangerous ideas and setting us on this path that we're on. And like you, I sometimes get a kick out of hearing those ideas. I watch those programs now and then, but I certainly don't take them as gospel. And I don't think you should either. Once in a while, it's healthy to consider other points of view that works in both directions. You know, some of us wish that mainstream science and academia would at least listen to some of what is discussed here. The opposite's also true. So tonight we're going to hear the mainstream view on some topics that have been discussed on Coast from time to time about human history and civilization. You know, like many of you, I get a kick out of reading about ancient civilizations now and then, even if it means I have to acknowledge that the evidence for, say, Atlantis isn't all that solid. And maybe humans didn't really need outside help to build a pyramid. So, you know, in the first half of this program tonight, I'm joined by anthropologist Dr. Kenneth Fader to explore current research and theories and evidence about such topics as lost civilizations, giants, mysterious places like Stonehenge and Easter Island, the first humans to explore North America. Who were they? When did they get here? As well as frauds and hoaxes, and there have been a bunch of them. Should be a learning experience for all of us, and I'll save time so you can get some questions in for Dr. Fader as well. Then in the second half, kind of a walk on the wild side with a man who has chased history in his own way by trying to make off with a bunch of it, specifically with treasure. Now, I admit I am a sucker for a good treasure story, gold and silver and diamonds and loot and booty. I think I was probably hooked on that topic as a boy, you know, reading things like Treasure Island. And I've always wanted to get into this topic on this program. Tonight we do. We jump in with both feet. W.C. Jameson has spent most of his life chasing treasure and chasing treasure stories and treasure maps. And he admits freely that a lot of what he's done is most likely illegal. Scratch that. Not most likely. It is illegal. Certainly dangerous. He's been shot at. He's been chased. He's survived encounters with banditos and government agents and other treasure hunters. He's dealt with scorpions and snakes and floods and cave-ins. He's sort of an Indiana Jones for profit and for adventure. That's coming up in the second half tonight. Our webmaster Lex and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities, culled from various media sources around the world. We call it Naps News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Included in the batch of stories there tonight, a recent treasure tale, just to kind of get us in the mood. It's from earlier this month, a bag of gold coins. I don't know what the value of this is, but it's up there, found in a very unusual spot. I think you'll like that story. Also, a think piece about the great scientist Galileo and his courage in standing up to the Inquisition, which, as this article explains, he did in somewhat devious ways. What would life be like in a city without cars? Well, there's a city in Spain that's taken that step, taken that road, and the results are pretty surprising. Also, a report that I held onto for this broadcast. It's about some very odd structures found in the Middle East, way out in the desert. And it's a good way, I think, to segue into our first guest tonight. That and more in tonight's Naps News. While you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. If you subscribe for a year, you can listen to the program anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any device. Gives you access to a vast archive of previous broadcasts. You can listen without commercials, plus other benefits for our members. And George Norrie's TV program, Beyond Belief, can also be seen via subscription. There are links there to check that out. It's fun and covers some of the same topics we discuss here. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, put on a pot of Joe, slip into those silky jammies, plop yourself down someplace comfortable, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio. In a moment, pseudoscience in archaeology. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Atlantis, was it real? Were there really giants among men, as referred to in the Bible and other publications? Did humans live alongside dinosaurs? Did aliens help build the pyramids? Modern archaeologists and anthropologists have to answer these kinds of questions, largely because of the popularity of the TV programs that raise alternative scenarios. And I think probably that people like my guest tonight get peppered with these kind of questions far more often these days than they used to be, but that's probably a good thing. You know, as I was mentioning a moment ago in the introduction, the popularity of these programs and the ideas that there was alien intervention all throughout human history, it's fun to consider sometimes, but it also kind of sells humans short on what humans were able to do on their own, in a sense. Our ancestors were capable of amazing things, even though they don't have the kinds of technology and education that we have these days. So I look forward to exploring the ideas that Dr. Fetter has written about in his book. The title of it is Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience in Archaeology. He has taught in the Department of Anthropology at Central Connecticut State University since 1977, where he's now a full professor. When he's not digging in the dirt and writing books, he likes to hang out with his wife, two kids, and four very bad cats. I'm going to ask about those cats. Dr. Fetter, thanks for being here with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, George.
I read the book, lots of really fun and challenging ideas, and okay. And I think it's healthy, especially for our audience, which you know, often hears very different views about human history and development and civilizations than what the mainstream is taught, what you teach in school. So I'm really glad you're here. Let's start with this. I want to start with talking about giants. And I ask that because it seems like there are stories about giants all over the place. I mean, there are references in the Bible, of course. Goliath, I guess, would be the quintessential giant that we hear about. But yeah, I know that here in Nevada, we have our own version of the giant story, the redheaded giants, mm-hmm. The Paiutes and other tribes supposedly encountered these giants, wiped them out. There's supposedly these giant bones that existed in a cave, and they were scooped up by the Smithsonian and went into a vault, and we'll never see them again. That kind of story is told all over the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. There, I mean, there are lots of myths, lots of stories about giants for sure. And the what you just brought up is a pretty common element in these myths, that some organization like the Smithsonian has this kind of infinite power to confiscate these materials and to have them disappear entirely. And having known people who work at the Smithsonian, I have to question that, because I'm not sure they're capable of doing of that kind of conspiracy. And ultimately it's a lame excuse for the question, okay, well, where are these bones? Why are we not finding them now? lots of stories in the past of them. And the one of the stories I tell in the Frauds book is the Cardiff Giant, which is a really well-known 19th century hoax. Just a hilarious story. We can get into that. But the bottom line with say, the story of the Giants is that, yeah, there are all these interesting, mostly 19th century accounts of the discoveries of these things. But where are they? The Smithsonian is incapable of performing this kind of perfect conspiracy to spirit all these things away and to drop them in the ocean or lock them away in a vault. So, you know, for those of us who are super skeptical about the existence of giants, meaning 10 feet tall, 11 feet tall, 12 feet tall, human beings on the earth sometime in antiquity, you could shut all of us up very easily by merely coming across with one of these specimens. That's where science works, right? Science always starts off skeptical about claims, and it's if you can if you've got the data, if you put up, then we shut up.
Science works basically, it advances based on mistakes, right? You try something, it doesn't work, you try something else. A lot of sciences anyway.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. That science always has to be willing. And that includes me and on the issue of giants or Atlantis or ancient aliens. We always have to be willing to consider new evidence, new data that may cause us to tweak what we think we know, to change it drastically, or even to overturn it. And even in the, you know, I've been teaching for more than 40 years, and I tell my students sometimes that at this point, I'm about as old as some of the sites I talk about. At least I feel that way. And even in those 40 years, some of the things that I have been able to teach my students have changed. And some of these things have changed rather dramatically because we are always open to new data. We're always looking for new data, new ways of explaining things, and we try to be as objective as possible in assessing the new data and reassessing what we think we know about the past. And that's what science is all about, absolutely.
Yeah, it changes all the time. I mean, and for a variety of reasons that you discuss in the book. You know, we're humans, after all. Historians, archaeologists, anthropologists, they're humans. Yeah, I know that some of the criticisms that you list in your book about pseudoscientists and some of the crazy claims that are made in TV programs and books and things of that sort are mainly aimed at the people who are pushing those tales about how they, you know, it brings them fame, they can make money. That's also true for mainstream scientists who sometimes fool around with the data and the truth.
Yeah, you know, look, you know, because scientists are trained, because they're dedicated to a particular field, they're passionate about it, it doesn't make us perfect. And there are those among us who want to believe something strongly that we, for whatever the reason. I'll give you a good example of that is probably the most famous archaeological, anthropological hoax ever, the Piltdown Man, the fossil found in England early in the 20th century that turned out to be the skull, the cranium of a modern human being cobbled together with the mandible, the jaw of an orangutan. And it was supposed to make it look like an early human ancestor was half man, half ape. And to be perfectly honest, after the discovery of Piltdown, there were any one of a number of scientists who embraced it without looking carefully enough. They suspended their disbelief. It was the fossil they wanted to know, the fossil they wanted to believe, and they weren't as skeptical as they should have been, and they didn't look at it carefully enough. And by the time we get, that's to say that's 1910, by 1950, when scientists went back and revisited it, and sure, there were new techniques, but also just looking at it more carefully, it became abundantly clear that the whole thing had been a fake. And perhaps if scientists had been more skeptical right from the get-go, that wouldn't have happened. But yes, scientists are susceptible to some of the same kinds of emotions and passions that people outside of science are, and sometimes we do not adhere to the scientific method perhaps as closely as we really ought to, and that we have to admit that. We understand that.
The Cardiff Giant, before we leave giants behind, tell that story for the listeners who may not remember that from reading about it in, say, high school or college.
Yeah, I mean, it's a spectacular story. And the reason I think I love the Cardiff Giant so much is it may have been the thing that inspired me as a kid to get interested in archaeological hoaxes. Because, you know, my parents, my mom, my dad, and my sister would head off in the summers for a couple of weeks on a car vacation in the Northeast for the most part. And they took me to, and I couldn't have been much more than 7 or 8 years old, to the Farmers Museum, which is up in Cooperstown, New York. Had to go with my dad to the Baseball Hall of Fame, but we also stopped at the Farmers Museum, which is a big open-air museum with old farm buildings scattered about. And as a kid, I remember very clearly seeing this giant statue. It seemed to be a statue, but this giant image of a man, a naked man. And at the time, it was just sort of secreted next to one of the barns. And reading a little bit of the text about it, that, wow, this was an archaeological fraud from the 1860s. And so when I began my career in archaeology, I wanted to revisit that story and learn more about it, and which is why I end up, you know, including an entire chapter about it in my book. It's 1869 in this little village of Cardiff in upstate New York near a city of Syracuse. A farmer, his name was Stubb Newell, hires a couple of men to dig a well on his property. They get down about 3 feet, and they hit something hard. And this is good floodplain soil, good alluvial soil. So there aren't any rocks in the soil. They get down about 3 feet, and they encounter something hard. And they call the farmer, Stubb, over, and they go, well, we don't know what this is. They clear off the soil a little bit, and it looks like two giant human feet, which is certainly something that you aren't expecting that at a depth of 3 feet in a farmer's field in Cardiff, New York. Stubb Newell, the farmer, was annoyed and perplexed, according to newspaper accounts, but he had the guys, you know, expand the dig a little bit. And as they expanded it, they saw that the feet were attached to ankles, were attached to legs, were attached to a torso, and ultimately when they were done, they looked down in astonishment at this amazing thing that they had in this pit in the ground in Cardiff. It was an entire giant naked man. And when neighbors started coming over and taking a look at everybody, the explanation that people came up with was, well, this guy must be petrified. And I know you're out in the Southwest there, George. You know about petrified wood, petrified forest, that national monument. And so the idea here was, well, maybe like if a tree could fall into some sandy, wet soil and decay and get covered up, but the actual tree matter, the organic matter, could be filled in with minerals and a perfect cast of a tree could be made. Well, gee, maybe that could happen to a person. And so the suggestion was that the Cardiff giant was the human equivalent of a petrified log, and that he was 10 or 11 feet tall. And how could that be? And of course, the initial explanation that was proposed was that this must be one of the biblical giants. And if you read the Bible, the Old Testament, there are multiple accounts of there being giants, and it's not just Goliath, although he's the archetype man. He's the model. He's the role model for all the giants. But you know, the kingdom of Og was inhabited by giants, and there are the Nephilim, who are these fallen angels who mated with human women and produced the race of giants. So the Bible has multiple references to the existence of giants like Goliath. And so, of course, it's 1869 in upstate New York. Ministers are going to glom onto this discovery. Say, I think that here in New York, there's been a discovery that supports one of the stories in the Bible, or several of the stories in the Bible, about there being giants. Of course, this guy Stubb, who was ostensibly just a simple farmer, like within a couple of days, he's erected a circus tent over this thing. He's hired a carnival barker, and he's charging people money to come and see it. And so there are these wonderful photographs taken by newspapers back in the 1860s of people in their frock coats and their top hats and ladies all dressed up in their finery waiting in line outside of the tent to be ushered in, to be given the story of the discovery of this giant. And it's just wonderful reading the firsthand accounts, because Stubb hired a carnival barker to be his docent, to be his museum guide, and people would walk into the tent. There was a large sheet placed over the giant, so there'd be this big dramatic reveal when the people were ready. They came in 25 at a time. The carnival barker would say, now behold the amazing vision of the Cardiff giant, and he would pull the sheet off. And one of the newspaper accounts actually said that grown men would gasp and women would faint at the sight of the Cardiff giant. So it's just this wonderful, you know, 19th century story of this excitement about this discovery. But, you know, George, almost immediately, and this is one of those deals where, yep, the scientists had to be the doubting Thomases. The scientists had to rain on everybody's parade, and people like, if you live in the Northeast, and you've ever been to the Museum of Natural History in New York. Or
I'll tell you what, Kenneth, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. We'll come back to that. Hold that thought. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about giants, Atlantis, a lot of other things. We're talking with Dr. Kenneth Feder, anthropologist, about frauds and hoaxes and pseudoscience in anthropology and history and archaeology. Giants is one topic. Atlantis will be another. The pyramids, maybe Göbekli Tepe, and a bunch of other stuff that has been discussed on this program and other programs still to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Kenneth Feder, we were talking about the Cardiff Giant hoax before the break, and it reminded me of, I think, P.T. Barnum or one of those showmen of that era came up with a mermaid, something similar that he cobbled together from different pieces, parts, and people paid to see it.
PG mermaid.
Yes, yeah, that's it. Yep. Just before we leave giants, the idea, you address it in your book, the idea that, giants from somewhere else coming to this planet and mating with human women, how unlikely that is just from the genetic standpoint.
Right. Well, that the story originates in the Bible, and so it's a religious tale. It's not history. It's not an anthropological tale. It's a tale taken from a book about God and how God created the universe and these angels and spirits. So it's almost applying something like a scientific analysis using something like the genetic argument here. I think it's beside the point for people who are believers in the Bible. But the point you're making is if the claim is made that there really were these giants and they came from somewhere else, you're right. The possibility of any two species that evolved on this planet being able to mate and produce offspring is extremely remote. And so the likelihood that something from somewhere out there that could come to Earth and mate with our ancestors and produce fertile offspring is so remote as to be, well, absurd. When we talk about ancient aliens, Eric von Däniken, in fact, said exactly that. He said that the aliens came to Earth and that we are the product, we today, human beings, are the product of interbreeding between those ancient aliens and animal ancestors here on Earth. And again, the same argument that, well, genetically, that is such the odds against that are so incredibly long as to be effectively zero.
There's some mystery DNA in there somewhere, right?
Well, that's when people use a term like mystery, the unfortunate thing is that we all take that term, that the vernacular is that, oh my gosh, there's this incredible
right.
mystery. And the fact of the matter is that we are learning more every day, and genetics is a field that has just, paleogenetics has blossomed enormously in the last few years. And the fact that there are things that we do not know, but we'll know tomorrow or we'll know the next day or know the day after that, that's the way science works. And to say that, well, there's mystery DNA is merely to say, We will know where it comes from. We will know what it is. We don't know today, but that doesn't mean we won't know tomorrow or the week or next week or next year.
Right. I mean, because what we know changes all the time. I guess a perfect example of it is, who were the first Americans? I'm really interested in that topic, in part because of the stories that relate to my home state of Nevada. We have a spirit caveman, really old remains that were found and carbon dated and became controversial, like Kennewick Man, and Clovis. Science thinks it knows who the first Americans were, but it changes all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, to say that it changes doesn't mean that it's a random process. Science is not a random process. It's a process of accretion, a process of development over the course of science develops over time. And so right back in the 1930s and 1940s, the common consensus was that Native Americans came from Asia, but maybe it's only a few thousand years ago. But again, because science is always a work in progress, we now know more. We now know that that date is insufficiently low. We now know that there are sites that date clearly to 15 or 16,000 years ago, and that maybe there's some good evidence of an entry into the New World as much as 20 or 25,000 years ago. The same is true in Australia, where, again, as we learn more, as our techniques get better, as our ability to date these sites improves, as our ability to find sites and excavate them, as that improves, we know more, and that's what science, again, is all about. The fact of the matter is that, though, that today we're coming to a point where the coalescence or the convergence of geological evidence and archaeological evidence and now especially genetic evidence all point in the same direction. All these things are converging to tell a story that, yes, something more than 20,000 years ago, human beings came from Northeast Asia into North America via the interior of the Bering Land Bridge or maybe along the coast, and they spread from there into the New World. The oldest skeletons in the New World that have been examined genetically are all traceable to Northeast Asia. And the geology makes sense. The climatology makes sense. The archaeology, again, makes sense. When we put all these pieces together, we get a firmer idea, a clearer idea of what was going on. But you know what? We may, 5 years down the line, we may learn something that causes us to revise our current consensus model or that to tweak it. But you get to a point in science where it's really unlikely that we're going to overturn it entirely. And I think we're there now, I think, in archaeology of the first Americans, is that we have a pretty good consensus. We may have to revise. We may have to push the numbers up. We may have to include some other possible sources of population. But overall, we are pretty confident in the model of the first humans coming from Northeast Asia something more than 20,000 years ago.
That's good. And more information would help clarify it again. I'm amazed at how even more recent events, historical events, things that seem to have been settled as factual change from time to time. In your book, you get into who were the first settlers of North America. You know, when I was in school, Columbus Day was a big deal. It was a holiday. 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and he generally got the credit. Of course, that was a long time ago. As you explore, there are a lot of different theories about who else may have been here long before him. Vikings, there are other less provable stories about lost tribes of Israel.
There are lots and lots of claims, but the bottom line here is that the archaeological evidence that we have shows conclusively that Native Americans came from Northeast Asia, again, like I said, more than 20,000 years ago, and that since that time, we do know that there was an incursion of the Norse across the Atlantic, entering into the New World, northern Canada, especially northeastern Canada, and that they left behind physical evidence. And that's the bottom. And the other claims that, well, maybe it's the Lost Tribes of Israel. That down there in New Mexico, you've got the Los Lunas Decalogue Stone. And in Ohio, you've got the Newark Holy Stones. And these are inscriptions, Hebrew inscriptions, that ostensibly are claimed by some to represent early settlers, early members of the Lost Tribes of Israel coming into the New World. But ultimately, an archaeological claim lives or dies. It stands or falls on the basis of the evidence, and when the evidence is lacking, inscriptions are easy to fabricate. An entire village is not so easy to fabricate. So yeah, there are a handful of these inscriptions, and they're really interesting. But in every one of these cases, with the exception of the Norse settlement at L'Anse aux Meadows and a number of other sites in northeastern Canada, when you look for the typical standard archaeological evidence that you would expect to be there if a settlement of people was there, throwing stuff away, losing stuff, living their lives according to their cultural traditions, which they brought from somewhere else, that's what archaeologists are trained to recognize. you know, your garbage and my garbage doesn't look like the garbage you would find at a 5,000-year-old site in Connecticut, which doesn't look like the garbage you would find in a 10,000-year-old site in Texas, which doesn't look like the garbage you would find in a 30,000-year-old site in Australia. Archaeologists are trained at recognizing the differences in the stuff people leave behind. And we know that people leave stuff behind. I mean, wherever people go, they leave a mess behind. And if there's nothing there, if you're claiming, if anybody claims that, well, it was ancient Phoenicians that were here, or Celts, or there were Chinese settlers, those are perfectly legitimate hypotheses. But again, they stand and fall on the basis of the evidence that's presented. And archaeologists like me, and yep, I'm you know, mainstream archaeologists, are always going to say, well, you know, show me the money. Show me where's the beef, or whatever other cliche you want to look at. Where is the evidence? And if the evidence is lacking, we are skeptical. But we are willing to be convinced. We are willing to change our minds. Every archaeologist I know is not doesn't have these things set in stone. They're willing to change their minds if evidence is forthcoming. And so we still wait for anything convincing for early settlement of North America beyond the Norse and, of course, Native Americans.
I think about even more recent times, and a lot of what we know as history, things that we think are settled, become fuzzy in time because of politics, current events. You know, I always learned that the Civil War was fought over slavery, and now I've heard in recent months it wasn't. And I've heard, you know, I remember, you know, hearing people say that the Holocaust didn't happen. Or, you know, and of course, as we know, history is written by the victors a lot of times. So history in general can change, not only because we learn new facts, because of current spin, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's absolutely true. What we hope, though, is that ultimately we come up with a story of what happened in the past that is as close to what actually happened as is possible. So we try to divorce ourselves from, like you say, these political perspectives where people want to cast the past in a certain way. And people have always done that, and we understand that. It's the job of professional historians and archaeologists and social scientists to try to leave those biases behind, always be willing to entertain new data. One of the things I know that's a really well-known historical event is the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And, you know, ultimately, we knew our knowledge was limited because, after all the members of the 7th Cavalry were killed, and the only eyewitnesses were Native Americans. So we got one side of the bat. We got eyewitness accounts from one side. But really, it's archaeology. It's the archaeology of that battlefield that has allowed us to reconstruct what happened there in far more detail. Because, you know, ultimately, what we archaeologists like to say is that, you know, the garbage doesn't lie. The material culture doesn't lie. It's got no agenda. You know, people when they're interviewed, they might say one thing or another. People may couch things in terms that they're more comfortable with. But the bottom line here is that the material record of the past got no agenda. It's just there, and it's up to archaeologists to recover it and try to see how that fits into what we think we already know about a historical event. So yeah,
let me ask you this: because of the popularity of programs like Ancient Aliens, do you, in general, do you get challenged by your students or by the general public? Do you get accused of being part of the cover-up? Why are you lying about history? Because of the success of those kinds of programs in the general media?
Yeah, I occasionally get accused of being part of some cabal or some conspiracy to keep things quiet. And when people say that, I mean, that's just such a silly claim that my reaction is always, oh, you got me. We all meet on alternate Thursdays at a church basement here in New York City. And, you know, this week it's my turn to bring the chips and salsa. Look, anybody who really knows archaeologists well knows that, you know, we couldn't pull off a conspiracy to save our lives. We all have our own agendas, our own ideas, and our own perspectives and our own egos. And trust me on this one, if I were to find something that would overturn what we knew about any aspect of the past, there's no reason for me to hide it. What would be my motive for hiding that? If I had the data, if I could prove it, I would be even more famous than I am. And I must be famous because I'm on your show, George. That's something.
Well, let me give you an example. We'll talk in this more in the next segment because we got about 3 minutes sure. before we go to the break. Ancient Egypt and the pyramids. And, you know, there's a lot of intrigue and skullduggery. And it's for a couple of centuries there. There's a lot of money involved in who's right about the true history of Egypt and who built the pyramids and hidden chambers and all that stuff. There's been thievery. There have been lies. There have been conspiracies among some of the researchers and very definite competition, spirited competition for who gets to tell the story and whose story is preeminent. Am I mischaracterizing it?
Well, here's the bottom line. Here's what I'll agree with. Yeah, I mean, archaeologists, Egyptologists have their egos, and they have their pet theories, absolutely, and competition, sure, absolutely. But what the bottom line here is, so what? You know, ultimately, what we see in ancient Egypt is very clear evolutionary development of the construction abilities, of the architectural abilities and engineering abilities of a brilliant people. And to kind of fall back on, well, there must be something else. Well, if there's evidence for that, share it for those people who say that. But the bottom line here is that, again, I think it's so much more interesting to consider the genius of humanity at being able to solve these very difficult engineering, architectural, mathematical, cylindrical challenges. The bottom line here is, you know what? You're going to lose money if you bet against human ingenuity, whether it's now or 10,000 years ago.
I've thought the same thing. The Ancient Aliens show, my one beef with all that stuff, well, among many beefs, but is that it really sells humans short for not giving them credit for being able to do this the amazing things.
I agree with you there, absolutely.
So ultimately, do you read the books, the popular books, Hancock and folks like that? Do you read that stuff so you can see where that element is going, where the thinking is going?
Yeah, essentially I do. In fact, Fingerprints of the Gods, I reviewed for American Antiquity, which is the journal of North American archaeologists. But yeah, and I've got a whole slew of Eric von Däniken's books, and sure. In other words, listen, you know, George, my dedication, my passion is for the past and teaching that past, getting the word out. And so I need to know what is floating out there in the ether that people have been exposed to either through books or magazines or websites or television shows. Because I have to react to something, right? What preconceptions are people bringing to my classroom, to me when they send me emails, or just in general, what preconceptions do they have because of their exposure to stuff like this?
Right.
Because I am remiss in my responsibilities as an archaeologist and as an educator if I just ignore that stuff, if I
right.
don't respond.
Dr. Kenneth Fader is my guest talking about archaeology, anthropology, pseudoscience. We're going to come back in a moment. I want to talk about Atlantis. We'll be opening up the phone lines for you as well.